Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Joining us for a look at this week's science stories is the one and only Charlie Limeweaver. Charlie, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Oh, thank you very much on this almost equinox evening.
Yes, and we'll have some special equinox questions at the end of this talk. Now, first up, the mystery of the missing matter solved. We're not talking about the dark matter here, are we? No.
No, we're not talking about dark matter. So here's the deal. Everybody should know this, that the universe is made out of 70% of the stuff in the universe, the energy density, is dark energy. So put that 70% away, and that's dark energy. Then another 25% is the dark matter. Now, 25 and 70 make 95%. Oh, that's the dark part of the universe. But the normal part, the stuff that's in the periodic table, normal, what we call baryonic matter, that makes up the remaining 5%. You got that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but the here problem is astronomers are trying to figure out where is this 5%? Because they count up, they look at the stars and they see the gold gas, they look everywhere and they say, hey, we're only finding half of this 5%. Where's the other half? And that's the missing mass problem that seems to have been resolved this past week by an Italian researcher who has been trying to do this for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And so the mystery seems to have been solved, and the short answer to the solution is X-ray halos.
Okay, you better explain.
Here's what the guy did. He and his group, he took two X-ray telescopes, and he looked at three different quasars. And in front of each of these quasars was a galaxy, a normal galaxy like our galaxy. And the idea was that when you look at X-rays, you're not sensitive to normal matter. You're only sensitive to really, 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 really hot stuff, like millions of degrees. And so by looking at quasars in the background and galaxies like ours in the foreground, if our galaxy also had hot, hot gas around it, then it would absorb the radiation from the quasar, the hot, hot, hot radiation. And that's what he found. It was a very weak signal to noise, but he had to stack these images in order to see, hey, even normal galaxies like our own have a million degrees hot circumgalactic halo that you can see in X-ray, and that's what he did. And so that's how we solved the missing baryon, the missing mass problem.
There we go. All right. Good on him. Now,
wait, let's give a little bit. This is a big thing.
Well, I know. I agree. Hurry.
He just found half the universe.
He just found 5% of the universe, exactly.
Well, half of 5%. Actually.
Half of 5%, exactly. Now, look, the very first stars, we already know that they were the largest stars, but a new computer model says they were perhaps 1,000 times larger than we thought. That's a big star.
That's a big mistake. If you think if something is really 1,000 times bigger than you, imagine buying a package from Amazon and having it 1,000 times bigger. That's a big mistake. Anyway, that's the type of mistakes we can make because we don't have a time machine. If we could go back in a time machine, you know, the universe is 13.8 billion years old. And what we're talking about here is the first 100 million years or so. So instead of 13.8, we're talking about 13.7. That's 100 million years from 13.8, you get 13.7. Anyway, so you go back in your time machine, and what we're trying to understand is, how did these galaxies form? I mean, the universe today is filled with stars and galaxies, all kinds of planets. But that wasn't the case if we go back in our time machine to 13.7 billion years ago. There, you just have the universe very, very dense, filled with hydrogen, essentially, and helium, no carbon, no oxygen, you couldn't make water, you couldn't make rock or anything. You just had hydrogen and helium. So proto-galaxies started to form, and that is, you get these clumps of material that started to form. Actually, have you heard of Paul Bunyan?
I've heard of Paul Bunyan, yeah. Go on.
Let me tell you about Paul Bunyan in the winter, the hard winter. It was so cold one winter that the mercury froze and the thermometers broke. And when people were talking to each other, their words froze in midair. And they had to wait the spring in order to hear what they were saying. But they couldn't understand because they were all unfroze at the same time. It was just like, anyway, the reason I'm telling you this story has a point, I promise. And that is, there's something called the Jeans mass in astrophysics. It's a little bit complicated, but you and I are, I'm talking right now. So what I'm doing is making the air vibrate. It's high density, low density, high density, low density, right? That's a propagating sound wave, high density, low density. In astronomy, when you have these high densities, but if they're big enough, instead of propagating, they gravitationally collapse. And that's, it's kind of like the words in the Paul Bunyan story. That's why I told you the story.
Yeah.
So have a vibrating mass on a big enough scale, instead of propagating, it collapses into a clump. And these clumps fall into each other. And this computer model modeled this thing called cold accretion, essentially means gas that's not so hot falling into the center of other gas, a protogalaxy that has a kind of a protodisk. And then it causes a shock wave. And this shockwave then produces these 1,000 times bigger stars than we were prepared for.
Hmm. Well, how about that? How about that? Exactly. Hey, now, speaking of big things, they have discovered the earliest evidence of a meteorite hitting Earth, and it's been found in Western Australia.
Yeah, this is Western Australia.
What about that?
In the Pilbara. Well, this is kind of interesting because, you know, as Earth scientists or as anybody who's interested in Earth, we know that the Earth formed by giant impacts. So bang, bam, 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 and get bigger. And the Earth got bigger and bigger. That's how the Earth got to be what it is today. But in the first half a billion years, these things were enormous. So, for example, we think the moons came from a Mars-sized planet that smashed into the proto-Earth, and then it made so much debris that debris then accumulated and formed the moon, around which we look at today. So pretty.
Right. Okay.
So, but the Earth is a really bad bombardometer. It's very hard to detect past bombardments. For example, you may have heard of the meteor crater in Arizona. That's only like 5 or 10,000 years old. So it's very, very recent compared to 4.5 billion. The moon is a much better bombardometer. That's why you can see so many big craters there and even little craters.
Yeah.
But the point is, we'd like to know more about the history of the bombardment of the Earth. And so you find the oldest parts of the Earth. You take a plug and make a hole and look down at the sediments. And what these guys did is, an Austrian scientist out in the Pilbara, he took a tube and then got a sample. And what he did was go through it very carefully. And what he found was, at 3.5 billion years ago, he found two very small millimeter-sized spherules. And you might say, well, what's that? So what? Well, the spherules, he could tell by analyzing what they were made of and their shapes, he could tell that they were the result of a bombardment. And the previous record holder was 3.48 billion years ago, and this is 3.5 billion years ago. What's weird is that we know that the first billion years was just boom, boom, smash everywhere, but we know so little, and so little of it has remained, that we have very little evidence for it. And so this is a big deal, finding the earliest evidence for the bombardment.
Yeah, no, it is, exactly. All right, some mice have two fathers, and this might chart a path towards curing some sex chromosome disorders.
Yeah, this is an issue that came out. There are two papers, one came out in Nature, one came out in Cell. And there's a guy named Murakami. He's a Japanese worker. He's working in Kyushu, University of Kyushu. And what he did was, there are the human disorders, and we'd like to figure out how to solve them, but most of these workers work with mice. And so this is a story about mice. So what he did was, he took an adult male mouse, and he took some cells from the tail of that mouse. About 10 years ago, scientists figured out how to get differentiated cells, like a tail or a head or a hair, or not hair, but skin cells, and turn them into immature cells. What I mean by immature cells, immature stem cells that can produce, that can grow into any other cell in the body, a heart cell or muscle cell, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy was one of the frontier people of doing that. But what he did was, he took a cell from this, like I said, a cell from the adult male tail, and the adult male tail has an X and a Y chromosome in it. And if it had two X's, it would be a female, and an X and a Y makes it a male. Now, what he did was, he took those cells, and then he made it immature, like I mentioned before, and then he cultured it. And when you culture human cells by themselves, they're kind of outside of a body, so they don't know where they are. Anyway, cell division is a little bit iffy. And so what happened was the XY, the male cell, lost a Y. A Y is a little bit of a piece of chromosome that's easily lost. And so he identified cells that only were just left with one X and the Y was gone. And then he said he had this little chemical called reversine, and he applied it to these cells that had only one X, and that also made it unstable. And then some of the cells got double X's in them. So the X was duplicated, and so essentially he had transformed a male sex cell into a female cell. So now this cell has two X's, but it was derived from the tail of a male mouse. And then what happens is you surround it with fetal ovary cells, and that kind of gets it ready to become an egg, and it turns into an egg that can be fertilized. And then you just add some sperm as usual, and then you get a fertilized egg. Then they implant it into a female mouse, and then out comes a pup. And so this is from two fathers, you have a fertile baby. And this is the world first. And so they're hoping that it's not ready for human consumption yet, but they're playing around with mice in this way that enable, I guess they're making the techniques to do this for, this is a mammal. Remember, the mouse is a mammal. So that's why they work with it. And what do you think of that, Phil?
Well, yeah, I know. What they're doing with cells and cell manipulation and gene edits and all of these things these days, I don't know.
Here's an example how they can cure some. Well, here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make cells that can grow into any organ. So if you have a problem with a kidney, you take one of your cells, you turn it into an embryonic cell, and then it grows into a kidney, and then you can grow your own kidney and replace it to the one that's faulty. Another thing it can do is there's something called Turner syndrome. That's people are born with just an X chromosome and no Y and no other X, just a single X. And that essentially they're largely infertile because of that. And so this technique has the potential of saying, okay, we can take your cell with one X, get another X in there, and then make an egg out of it. So that's way down the road, but I think that's the direction this stuff is going in.
Hmm. Now, tomorrow, Charlie, at 8:24 a.m., will be the equinox.
In Sydney time, yes.
Hmm. This is 8:24 a.m. Eastern time, that's right.
Yes, that's right.
It will be the equinox. The real equinox, exactly. So for those who think the change of season should be rung in, that's the time we can do it. What is an equinox anyway?
Well, that's what I'm asking you, Phil. Before I give you the answer, a little quiz tonight. What is the equinox, Phil? What is that? Did you learn some astronomy in high school or something?
We're a certain distance away from the sun.
No, but I bet you know some Latin.
Our angle of inclination towards the sun is halfway between full and not full.
You did so much law and so little astronomy. Okay, here's you did some Latin. You know some Latin. What does equinox mean?
Fill me in.
Equa is equal.
Yes.
And nox is
night. So that's right. Yes. So daytime and nighttime are the same.
That's it.
Hey!
A little bit of Latin. Anyway, so what's cool about this is right now, well, tomorrow at this time, if you have a camera at the North Pole and a camera at the South Pole, the sun goes exactly around the horizon, is at the horizon, both the North Pole and at the South Pole. And it goes and it stays there. It doesn't get high, it doesn't get low. It just stays on the horizon. And matter of fact, if you Google equinox from the South Pole, you can see a guy took a camera for 5 days just before the equinox from the South Pole, and you can see the sun just above the horizon, just barely going around and around and around for 5 days. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. Is it possible to distinguish sunrise from sunset from an image without knowing the time of day or whether you're looking east or west?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, I thought. And I thought,
in other words, does dawn and sunset, can they look the same?
Yes, sunrise and sunset. I mean, you'd think geometrically they're the same, right? If the sun is coming up or the sun's going down.
Down.
But I think everybody has a little bit of a feeling about this. What do you think?
Well, I'm wanting to say no, because I've experienced both, and the sunrise sunlight seems different to me.
Well, yeah, so then you could tell the difference then.
Yeah.
If it seems different, what kind of difference? Some people have described this as the dawn is kind of like whiter or lighter.
It's whiter and lighter. That's it.
And the sunset is redder and oranger.
Yeah, it's redder and softer. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And that's what a lot of people say. And I think that's the truth. And the reason for that is that when you're looking at the sunset, you're looking through hot air because all the air around you has been heated up during the day. Mm. And so it has more moisture in it. And therefore, it scatters more of the blue out. And therefore, it looks redder.
Oh, okay.
While in the sunrise, the air is cold, has less moisture in it, and therefore it scatters less of the blue out, and so it looks whiter. At least that's what I think the explanation is.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm sure. That sounds convincing to me. Anyway, hop out there with your favorite equinoxian costume and ring it in. Tomorrow, Eastern time, 8:24 a.m. Charlie, great to talk. Thank you.
All right. Happy Hallow Equinox to you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.